In 2007, the Babylon podcast was our last best hope for more Lost Tales. We thought it failed. But after WonderCon, it became something more. Our last best hope for more Lost Tales geeking. The year is 2008. The name of the show is the Babylon Podcast. And welcome back to another Babylon Podcast. I am Summer Brooks.
I am Tim Callender.
And we have no Jeffrey.
Oh, I know. Sad for us, but good for him, because that means he's working.
That is. But we miss the Vorlon.
I know we do.
I'm starting to miss the puns, and I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing.
I think, isn't that Stockholm Syndrome?
Ooh.
I mean, I'm just saying.
Uh-huh. Oh, well.
Hey, a little bit of quick news. Uh-huh. A couple episodes ago, we brought up the fact that JMS was slated to pen the script for the remake of Forbidden Planet. And unfortunately, I didn't print this all up, but apparently on Ain't It Cool News, there were rumors floating about that it was going to be a very retro sort of thing. It was also going to be more of a continuation of the story,
right.
A sequel of sorts. And then, just to clarify things, JMS on the JMS News Group basically came out and debunked all that.
He basically said, sorry, Hans, wrong guess. Would you like to go for double yeah. Jeopardy where the scores can really change?
Yeah. No, it's Forbidden Planet. Altair 4 explodes. It's just more that he's, you know, looking to pay homage to the story. Without changing the essence of the story.
And so, I for one, think he is more than capable of doing that. He appreciates the history of sci-fi. So I don't think it'll be a crap remake. I really don't.
Well, I don't think he will write a crap remake. It's hard to say because I happened to see today some stills from the upcoming J.J. Abrams Star Trek movie.
Uh-huh.
And looking at the production design for it and the design for the new Enterprise, it's, for me, a big, giant, resounding meh.
And that's been my whole thing the whole time. I'm not that huge a fan of the original Star Trek series.
Well, and I guess more to the point of Forbidden Planet, I mean, you know, on the ones... That sounded like something broke in the kitchen. Anyway. You know, as dated as some of that looks, I mean, how do you improve the design of Robbie the Robot?
I don't know that you can without causing all-out revolt.
Right.
But, so, you know, I could be wrong. There might be ways to make them look more futuristic without losing the essence of them. Because I wasn't one of those people who was so tied to Battlestar Galactica that I didn't want anything to change. I actually like the new Centaurians, you know?
Yeah.
And that design is it evokes a memory of the original ones, but the new ones are kind of slick. And if I had $8,000 lying around, I just might get that 8-foot-tall model and stick it in my living room to scare off any potential burglars.
Yeah, okay. I'll give you that. I guess really more to the point is how do you improve upon Anne Francis?
I don't know. I will leave that up to the experts.
Yeah,
I'm not. Yeah, I am not even going
to
speculate on casting at all.
No.
Not even going there.
I, you know what, to be honest with you, at this point, and this is kind of my feeling with the Lensman project too, until it actually gets a production green light, it's all nice to talk about. I'd love to see the scripts, but...
Mm-hmm. And they're not actually going to even tap a director for this until the script is finished, right?
I don't know. I haven't heard anything about that. I know, like, in the past, I was reading with James Cameron was attached to the project for a while.
But he's been busy the past 25 years with Avatar, so.
Yeah. Right, exactly.
It seems like that long.
Yeah, no, and that's the point. I mean, this particular remake project has been on again and off again for a long time, you know, and even with Straczynski writing a script, there's no guarantee it'll be made. Silver Surfer apparently has gone into development hell.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's doing a rewrite on Thor. You know, who knows what Changeling is going to bring his way. It might be more scripts that are non-genre related.
I actually don't know how Changeling is done at the box office. I know it's gotten a lot of critical praise.
Mm-hmm.
We shall see. So, anyway. Like I said, I reserve any judgment because technically we don't have a script yet. We don't have a storyline yet. We don't have a director or a cast yet.
Yeah.
Once a director and a cast are set, I may cheer or I may cry. Right now, I don't have enough data to feel anything either way, other than I'm giving it a chance because JMS is writing it.
Right, right. And I'm right there with you.
That's about
it. If they had to do it, at least let somebody like him take a crack at it.
Yes. All right.
So, all right. Well, there we are.
That'll do it. We'll come back really, really quickly and assuage your hunger for deep geeking.
On the next Babylon 5.
Somebody's got to stop Sheridan's war against Earth.
As the battle rages on, Garibaldi is forced to choose.
So how do I prove I'm in all the way?
Give me Sheridan. We have to take him out of the picture.
And the legacy of the Shadows is about to be reborn.
What am I?
Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. guest stars.
We're going to change the world, Mr. Garibaldi.
On the next Babylon 5.
Answers to What is the Weird Show? Take one.
It's a weird weekly audio show available for free.
It's about an hour long.
Though it seems longer.
You understand it's free. This is very important. You understand this, right? Free.
And it's still available at theweirdshow.com.
Did you catch what I said earlier about it being free?
The mundane media covers all that can be known. The Weird Show covers the rest.
Okay.
Hey, I kind of like that. Weird news, strange ideas, odd views. TheWeirdShow.com.
Digging down into the most obscure facts and fandom, this is
And welcome back to your only source of in-depth, supremely geeky Babylon 5. Examinations.
Yeah. We already had the examination. We had an interlude with that, in fact.
Oh, the puns. Enough with the puns.
Now tonight we are deep geeking on the exercise of vital powers. And yes, I exercise my vital power to make puns.
Mm.
Yes, so there. I mean, what is it that, what is it that Edgar tells, Garibaldi about the Greeks and
you're putting me on the spot now.
No, I've got it here. Get how the ancient Greeks defined happiness. They said was the exercise of vital powers along lines of excellence and a life affording them scope. Yes, I did happen to be reading from In Purple I'm Stunning, so there.
That's okay. I brought my copy of Volume 10 with me of the script books because I had to do some rereading to make sure I actually heard a particular line of dialogue correctly, and we will get to that later.
Okay, I was going to say, did you want to start there or not?
Well, what I like about the episode is this seems to be set up to be a standalone, even though everything that happens in it is integral to the rest of season 4. The I don't know if it was an homage to the old hard-boiled private investigator type stories that that we know Garibaldi loves, but the opening dialogue and the closing dialogue is right out of one of those pulp novels. Yeah,
it tried to kill me three times.
It tried to kill me. I said I'd never come back, and yet here I am. That's straight out of Hard Boiled, man. That's awesome.
Yes. And I loved it. Actually, it really set the tone. Was it a bit cheesy? I mean, even that scene with Wade in the transport tube. You know, I mean, it was that whole. Not one-liners, what's the word I want, but just real, you know, cut-to-the-chase sort of dialogue. Would you believe that I got a master's in literature? You don't seem the type. Everything's illusion. I mean, just, you know, but it works so well.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, we get the bit with, I mean, back to the hard-boiled stuff, Wade ends up being, you know, a stone-cold killer when all said and done.
And we kind of knew that.
Yeah, I know, but it's interesting because, you know, that he, again, he's a character we don't see much of, but there's this depth there. And I was just reading, in fact, where Straczynski says that what he really likes to do with his characters is not invent them so much as peek in on their lives. In other words, he deals with them as though they've been real people going about what they're doing, and when it's time for him to tell the story, he's just simply peeking in on what they're up to. And Wade, to me, is one of those characters. You know, I mean, you're right. You get the sense that he could do whatever is necessary, but, man, you know, this Wade will take care of your payment, Miss Constance.
Yeah, I wasn't expecting that. Literally was not expecting that. But I like there's that hard-boiled theme follows through there because you've got Wade, who is sort of the I'm coming to you on behalf of someone I work for who needs your help kind of intermediary.
Yeah.
Then there's
when will that be? 5 minutes after he lets me know and I come to get you.
Exactly. And then you've got the surprise jump in the middle of the night. Are these the bad guys who don't want him to talk to the boss? Is the boss has the boss learned something that, you know, he doesn't trust him anymore and he's got to get rid of him, got to silence him, got to X him out or whatever.
Right.
And there's little touches of, you know, that pulp noir tale elements of that just all throughout this entire episode. And just the whole way he's set up, he's like...
Oh, and the old flame, too?
Oh, yes.
We'll get to that.
The dame. Down. It's the dame. The damsel in distress, you know. The trouble, the lady in the red dress.
Right, exactly. And then, you know, the love that he never was able to what's the word I want? Not unrequited, but, you know, they could never get it together, but he's still holding a torch for her.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. I mean, I had never really thought of it in those mm-hmm. terms, but Summer, I think you hit it right on the head.
And literally, when she walks in there, she's talking to him when they're alone. That's the hold, and you know, why'd she have to come walking through my door set up?
Yeah, right. And all the mansions and all the domes on Mars, why'd she have to come in on this one? But you know, I will say this: one of the things that struck me watching this again, and that scene where Garibaldi is talking with Lys, and, you know, he admits that he's still holding out a flame, you know, it's never been the right time for us kind of thing. It made me reflect on some that scenes between Catherine and Sinclair all those years ago, almost a lifetime ago. And the thing that I really noticed is that whether it's just time and experience or whatever, the ones with Garibaldi and Lys ring emotionally true in a way that the ones between Sinclair and Catherine never did for me. Mm. You know, how much of that is the writing, how much of that is the acting, I'm not sure, and you may not be able to tease them apart. But I really, you know, her emotion when she's telling Garibaldi, you know, you've never been there for me, and he's like, well, you know, I wanted to, and she's like, would you have left Babylon 5 when I called you?
Yeah.
You know, and we all know the answer would have been no, but he's trying to hedge his bets. And he's like, well, I'm not sure. And she's like, I'm not sure, it's not good enough for me. It's, you know, and you can tell she even still is holding something for him. But she's just got to move on. You know, that's where she is with it.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
And I really think that the casting of Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. as Eggers was
man.
A brilliant stroke.
Oh, yeah.
And when he shows up, I mean, he's obviously much older than she is. But he's got this thick shock of hair. He looks fit and trim. I mean, you know, he looks like the old shark who is now staying alive because he's crafty rather than, you know, at one point in time he was just strong. Now he's crafty, you know, and you just don't want to mess with that guy.
Yep. He's and he went from being the strong, the young, the tough to the sneaky, sly, who'll smile at your face at the same time having somebody else stab you in the back for him.
Yeah. And it's all business. I mean, that's the other thing. You know, I mean, his response about Clark wasn't so much that, you know, that it's a moral imperative to get mm-hmm. him out of power.
Yeah,
he wants Clark gone because it's bad for business.
Yeah, it's hurting business. And, you know, you're messing with my bottom line. I got to do something about you.
Right, exactly. You could have done whatever you wanted, except you had to go mess this up.
And not just for one corporation, for like four or five of the big ones. And
yeah.
You can say they're like, okay, all right, your games have now starting to cost us. That's enough of that.
Yeah, yeah. And one of the things I also that struck me watching this, especially that scene where Garibaldi and Eggers first meet face-to-face. Garibaldi, and again, this gets back to your hard-boiled gumshoe analogy, Summer. Garibaldi, for all his smarts, he really does seem like now he is way out of his depth.
Mm-hmm. He's just not comfortable.
Right, exactly. Exactly. He can't sit in the chair. He's up and walking around. You know, I mean, he's got the smarts. He's got some of it, you know, puzzled out. You know, as he tells Eggers, well, you know, you're not going to hire me just to be moving this stuff. You're hiring me because your neck's on the line. You just don't want anybody to figure out what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
But he just doesn't know how deep it is. And whether or not he understands that Eggers ultimately regards him as a tool that can be disposed with once its usefulness is over with, I don't know that Garibaldi at this point has that sense.
I honestly think it's more compelling than that. He's coming to Eggers because, A, he wants to meet the guy he's been working for. B, you know, like it or not, Lisa's on Mars, and he can't help himself on some level with that.
Right.
And Eggers is the most powerful person. He's associate. He knows. And who else is he going to go to regarding his qualms about Sheridan's actions?
Yeah, you're right. And he does bring that up.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody's got to stop him. And that's, and we can get back to Eggers. That's Eggers' whole problem with Sheridan, isn't that, you know, he's as the future president of Earth points him out, you know, he's doing the right thing in the wrong way.
Mm-hmm.
What Sheridan is doing is bad for business, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these guys, if they could just stop messing with the marketplace.
And what I think is funny, I have to look at some of the things that Garibaldi said to Eggers, and I wonder if that was his programming telling him that, like bringing up his deepest insecurities and deepest, you know, unsaid thoughts and using it to reel Eggers in, because the Garibaldi that we knew before that, I don't think he would have thought for a minute that Sheridan wanted to take over for himself. He knew better.
Yeah.
He knew at the start of when Severed Dreams, when they said they were going to secede, he knew that Sheridan didn't want the power. He didn't want to take over EarthGov himself.
Yeah, yeah, but that's also before he came back from the dead. I mean, that's one of the interesting things. Is you know, I was trying to recall my initial responses to this episode when it first aired, and I first watched it. And again, on some level, I knew that what Garibaldi's deal with Sheridan was due to the programming. I mean, I think that was fairly obvious.
Mm-hmm.
But then that scene where Franklin is talking to Sheridan about why Sheridan's so antsy about the telepath.
Oh, yeah.
And he comes out of med lab.
Yeah, we have to go through that whole set.
You know? And you know, Lita asks him, and there's Franklin going, I would never have believed it. And, you know, and he says, the Sheridan, before he went to Zahadum, would never ask what he's asking.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we don't know quite yet what that is.
True.
But, you know, the point is that is just the one, there's that one little seed of doubt all of a sudden that gets tossed in. And you know, I never believed that Sheridan would be after the whole kit and caboodle for himself, but it just makes Garibaldi's doubts that much more believable.
I wonder. Yeah, Garibaldi knew he wanted to use the telepaths against Clark before he left. He just didn't know in what capacity. So maybe that was part of his mistrust.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Interesting. Something to think about. But, yeah, the whole cat and mouse game being played between Edgars and Garibaldi. At one point, it seems kind of obvious who's the cat and who's the mouse. But when you look back after Garibaldi's deprogrammed, you wonder who's really toying with who.
Yeah. Yeah. Because, again, when all is said and done, Eggers has the one Achilles heel. I'm not sure that's the right term, but his thing about telepaths, you know, as we find out later on, spoiler alert, well, anybody who's been listening to the podcast by now knows we're all in spoilers. But what Eggers is plotting to do to telepaths, which of course is part of what Bester's thing was with getting Garibaldi in there and so forth, so on, you know, that is above, I mean, on the one hand, you could say maybe telepaths having them around are bad for business. On the other hand, you know, that's an irrational fear that, you know, I mean, he's gone to extreme lengths to try to solve that problem. And knowing that his solution, his final solution, if you will, is going to cause problems, that's mm-hmm. why he hires Garibaldi to do what he's doing.
Right.
Because, yes, his neck is on the line.
Mm-hmm. And it's actually a very interesting thing that they find a common ground in their fears about telepaths. They're afraid that, you know, telepaths will take over. That's what Garibaldi says. He says, you know, they can lie to us. How do we know they're lying? But if we lie to them, they know. It's not fair. And for Garibaldi, it's been, for a lot of mundanes, to use their term, it's fear of someone else having more power. And that's Edgar's fear, just on a different, a broader scope, a wider scale.
Right. Yep, yep. And of course, at the very end of that scene where he's being interrogated by Edgar's, do you still have feelings for my wife? And Garibaldi goes just straight at the telepath. Says, no, I don't. It's like...
And part of that, and part of Edgar's never saying a word about that makes me wonder, because, you know, that would be something I would have wondered if Wade would have brought up. He says, hey, do you think this would be a problem? And I look at it as Edgar's having an extra chip because he knows that what he's doing is dangerous. He knows that everything he's doing could come back, slingshot back, and affect what he's built up and affect the people he cares about. So having someone who works for him, who's still in love with his wife, he may be thinking, you know, he may just go out of his way to protect her, to, you know, sacrifice himself to make sure she's safe, because he did it once on Babylon 5.
Yeah.
And having that, what he might consider an ace in his pocket, going, you know, Garibaldi's a survivor. If things go really, really, really bad, you know, he can, I think it lets him free himself up to save his own skin And part of him knows that Garibaldi will get Lys out of the line of fire at risk to his own life.
Well, now, when you say that, Summer, do you think that Eggers really cares for Lys in that he's so concerned for her that having Garibaldi there is a safety net for her safety? Or do you think it's that, well, if Garibaldi's there and he will throw himself on the grenade for Lys, that Eggers won't feel any personal recrimination or guilt of saving his own skin at the expense of his wife?
Maybe a little bit of both. Because I know he trusts Lys. Lys won't cheat on him. Mm-hmm. And Garibaldi cares too much about her to push it. So he's not worried about an affair under his nose. But if he thinks that Garibaldi would literally move the moons of Mars and throw himself on the grenade to make sure Lys is safe, I think he thinks that frees him up a little bit.
Okay.
I mean, somebody that smart, that methodical, and that secretive about his plans, he can't not ignore that as a potential asset.
Okay, I can see that. I guess the thing is, especially with what's revealed about Eggers in this episode, and at the end when they've got the, as we find out, the dying telepaths lying there. I'm not sure that he, you know, I get the sense that emotional attachment is good for business until it's no longer good for business.
Mm-hmm.
So having Lys around, you know, and I'm not saying that she's just there as necessarily as a trophy wife for him. I think he exhibits genuine affection for her. But I just wonder, again, if it becomes bad for business to have her around, if he would have, you know, that he would have no compunction about kicking her to the curb, or, you know, all right, the whole house is collapsing around me. It's more important. It's better for business to save my own skin, mm-hmm. you know, and, oh, well, it's a shame. Lys was very nice and very attractive, but there are other nice, attractive women out there that would be happy to be hooked up with Blaine Eggers. I don't know. That's one side of it we never quite see. And that end, you know, there's the other part of it. It's that ending scene. I know, I'm sure this is not the line that you're looking for, but with Wade and Eggers looking at the telepaths, I mean, he almost seems, again, I mean, there's a certain compassion there. You know, you're suffering, it'll be over soon. And then he's like, well, put them down. And that's the word he uses, put
mm-hmm.
them down.
Yeah.
Like they're
dogs or something, yeah.
It's like, and then he comes, you know, and then he boomerangs around again with a, you know, let's not cause any more suffering until we have to.
Yeah, he's being very pragmatic about it. And it humanizes him in a scary way. Because he doesn't want to see them suffer any longer. He's like, okay, you know, we've proven the what it can do. We have all the data we need. Just go ahead, end their suffering. You know, like you said, put them down. You know,
right.
that little bit of coldness comes through at the same time. He's like, he doesn't want to see them suffer anymore, but he's also not broken up.
Right. Right. And he doesn't want to see them suffer anymore, so give them what they need to make them better. You know, it's put them down. And you're right, it's scarier because it's not, there's no, you know, there's no insanity. He's not like this drooling monster,
mm-mm.
you know, flexing his power. I'm powerful, I can do this.
Yeah.
It's, you know,
he's
stone cold
he's,
opposite. Again, it's all about business. It's going to be, you know, this is why he's doing it.
Yeah.
I don't really want to have to hurt them, but I'm going to have to hurt them. But we don't need to hurt them right now.
Yeah, the kindly old gentleman who just happens to, you know, torture telepaths in his spare time.
Right. Well, and see, that's the thing. He doesn't see it as torture either. And that's the thing that's almost,
it's not
to say torture is a good thing, but it's like, this was an experiment.
It's field testing of his virus or
right.
any antidote.
Yeah. And that's scary stuff because, again, there's no moral compunction there. There's no, I don't know, it's, you know, there's certainly he's traveling by his own moral compass, not society.
Interesting.
Scary character.
Kind of makes you wonder about the other Megacore, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It's like, what are those guys up to?
Yeah. He might also, you know, it might also be the kind of thing, as, you know, Garibaldi points out, you know, you've got contacts, you've got guys in your pocket. It might be that, and I don't know, this is just pure conjecture, but it might be a situation similar to Londo and the other members of Centauri Great Houses dealing with Cartesia. Well, everybody knows something's got to be done.
Mm-hmm. They're just afraid to do it because their heads might end up on a stick.
Right. And Eggers is like, okay, well, damn it, somebody's got to do it. I, you know, might as well be me. Y'all aren't going to do it. I'm doing it because it has to be done.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, and then it comes to the end where Garibaldi basically is ready to sell out Sheridan.
Yeah, that.
And I got to. I'm sorry. Go ahead. You go first.
That whole scene where, you know, Edgars is saying, "Okay, I've you have to live up to your end of the deal, so that I know you're really all the way in with us."
Yeah.
And he's like, "Okay, you say you're in, but you have to prove it.
Yeah,
can you do?" He says, "I can give you Sheridan." And he's like, "Well, tell me how. How do I get to Sheridan? You get to Sheridan through his father. We can't find his father. Here's how you find him." And then you see the not excitement, but almost greed on Edgar's face, where he realizes, "Oh, okay, this is coin I can use."
Yeah, yeah. And Garibaldi, it's really interesting. He's dragging his heels, and yet, you know, it's like he can't stop himself.
Yeah.
He knows. As Edgar says, give us Sheridan. It's like, I won't give him to Clark.
Right. Because, you know, he doesn't want him killed. He's like, you know, he's still my friend. I do not, because Clark will kill him, plain and simple.
Right.
I do not want to hand him over to be executed, plain and simple.
Right. And Edgar's, of course, like, well, no, you know, we got to put him on trial. We got to give him, you know, do something. We got to throw Clark a bone before we toss him over. But no, everything will be fine.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right.
So, yeah, we have that whole scene where you see Garibaldi struggling, and he finally gives me information, and then he's like, "Okay, you go set it up. You have to be the one that sets it up, because he's not going to believe it coming from anybody else."
Yeah.
And then you see, like, that's the other penny dropping, and you see Garibaldi, oh, boy.
Yeah.
And that leads up to the whole scene at the end where he's in the transport tube where, you know, he says, "This time it did the job. I don't feel anything anymore."
Yes.
And that the one part that caught my ear this time was the line, where is it? "I can't feel anything anymore. I don't know what to care about anymore except for Lise." And then he says, "Maybe we just have to live with it and get on with it and do what we have to do, never what we want to do." And then that pause, he says, "It has to be done. I hope he can see that someday." And at that very moment, I wondered what was he talking about. Was he talking about Sheridan? Was he talking about the submerged real version of himself? I had never heard him say, "I hope he we'll see that someday." I never heard the "he" in there. I'm like, okay, who is he? Who's the "he" he's talking about?
Ooh, see, I heard it, but I always assumed it was Sheridan. But wow, what a great wrinkle if he's referring to this the submerged, repressed Garibaldi, the one in the fogged up mirror.
Mm-hmm. Because he's saying we do what we have to do, never what we want to do, right?
Yeah.
And you know, you think on first blush that he's talking about Sheridan, and then you think about it later, And is he talking about the programmed version of himself? You know, the programmed version of himself is doing what it has to do.
Yeah.
And the real Garibaldi, the unprogrammed Garibaldi, very, very likely would have died before right. giving up Sheridan, before giving up anything on Sheridan.
Yeah. And even with that, it's still trying to fight that programming. I think that whole comment is, I'm not turning him over to be killed, is that desperate plea of, you know, because when he delivers it, I really get the sense that he doesn't necessarily believe it,
mm-hmm.
when he's saying it. You know, I mean, there's the sense that he knows as soon as he hands Sheridan over to whomever that
he
all
has
bets
to
are
know.
Off.
Yeah, he has to know that eventually Sheridan will be killed, even if it's the, you know, they hold him for a week, a month. Eventually, if Clark wins, Sheridan's life is forfeit.
And even if Clark loses, Sheridan's life could be forfeited because who knows what Eggers is going to do with him.
True.
You know, that's the thing. Garibaldi, he's got to know that handing Sheridan over to whomever might be just signing his death warrant.
Right.
Yeah. But that's interesting. I never really thought of those final lines in terms of that submerged personality, and that's a really chilling wrinkle to it all. That's
this
really
is,
cool stuff.
This is what happens when you watch the episodes more than 10 times each.
Yeah, right. Right. You start overthinking it, maybe, but even still, it still works.
Yes, it does.
Yeah, and the one thing that I did notice is that at the beginning, when he's delivering his personal log, and he's talking about coming to Mars and that Sheridan's finally, you know, pulling the trigger, there's this repressed fury in his delivery. And then that final monologue,
where he's just, you know, resigned. He's
right. There's no emotion.
He's done
in it,
yeah.
at all. Yeah, he's beat. He's finally, you know, I came to Mars and finally did the job. I don't feel a thing. and this is one of those episodes. Again, it's similar to Hour of the Wolf, where Jakar is captured by the Centauri. It's like this is, you know, it's like it's. Another turn in the roller coaster. I don't know. When I first saw this episode, it really had a great impact on me because I really felt like once again, the series was changing tone
mm-hmm.
and going in a completely different direction than what I expected.
Yeah. Interesting.
So.
Okay. So really quickly,
yeah.
we have to talk about Franklin's adventure
yes.
with the, yes. the telepaths and the shadow implants.
Yes. And Lita.
Yes. And Lita, the fact that they never thought about Lita as a potential help is something about that bothered me.
Uh-huh.
Because wouldn't you ask for a telepath's input or insight when working with other telepaths, especially uh-huh. ones who had been – you have telepaths here who have been – who have had shadow technology forced upon them. Wouldn't you go to a telepath who you knew had extensive contact with the Vorlons?
You would think. And even more discomforting for me was when Franklin finally hunted Lita down and said, you know, can you work with me on this?
Mm-hmm.
His response wasn't, you know, hey, let's do this work together. It was like, again, she's almost like a tool to be used. You know, I've been beating my head against this problem for weeks now. The captain is chewing my ass to get it done. Look, here's a potential solution. And
mm-hmm.
he's not, again, he's not thinking about Lita at all as Lita.
Lita as an instrument.
Right, as exactly. A, yeah.
And I think the way he did that was intentional, because if you go back and examine season 3 and season 4 where Lita is around,
uh-huh.
It literally is thinking of her as a tool, an instrument, a weapon.
Yeah.
And that leads up to a lot of her feelings come out when Byron arrives in season 5.
Yep, exactly.
And yeah. I think that was actually, it might have been a little heavier handed in this episode because you noticed it. In the other episodes, you didn't really notice it until you went back and watched it later afterwards. And you're going, oh, yeah, wow, look how they asked her that.
Yeah, right. And on the flip side, I thought Zach was the only one, again, treating her like a human.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've got a perp. I need you to help identify. And he's like going, no, I know what your rules are. The victim is asking for this. You know, and you could see her soften.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, here's my rates. And he's like, you know, I mean, he comes with the whole thing of he's doing a friend a favor, someone who needs a job.
Right.
I can help you out.
Throwing her some business, right.
Right, exactly. That's exactly it. I'm bringing you some business. It's not, I need you to do this for me. It's like, you know, here's an opportunity for you, you know? I need your help, but I'm not here to use you. I'm here to, you know, we're going to do some business and it's going to help you out and everything will be happy. And you know, you can see her reaction to him is the same thing. So, yeah, great stuff. That is just really,
mm-hmm.
really cool stuff.
Yeah.
It's one of those, like you said, it's sort of a standalone, it's sort of in between, but to me, it really felt like a crucial episode in a lot of ways when I first saw it. And again, watching it this time, I just, the emotional mm-hmm. heft of it is very impressive.
The tone of it sets it apart from the episodes that come before it and after it. So
yeah.
it's not really a standalone in terms of content, but just in tone, in feel.
Yeah.
And, it just sets up everything for more good stuff to come.
Yep. All right. Have we tore this one apart?
I think we have.
Put it back together again?
Maybe. Like, we have to leave a few loose threads dangling for our for people to call in feedback for.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
All right. That'll do it for our deep geeking. We'll be right back after a quick break to wrap this up.
Jericho, a small, ordinary Kansas town. Normal until something happened.
All right, it looks like the explosion came from the west, maybe Denver.
What if it was an attack, Sheriff? And there's chaos out there? You might not want the wrong people knowing that Jericho was still here.
I love the community feel of everybody having to work together after this big disaster. Even though they have their own problems, they come together when they have to.
Now we can get the power back on. We can find out how big this thing is. If we have to, we can fight. We can fight anybody. We can fight all enemies. The only way that's going to happen is if we work together.
Fans have already been vocal about this series, but it's time to give them a new voice.
Having grown up on SAC bases, that's Strategic Air Command bases, nuclear war was a reality for me. When I first saw the previews for Jericho, I was really interested to see how Hollywood was going to portray what happened after a nuclear event.
Join your hosts, Heidi, Suzanne, and Larissa, for Future Traditions, a podcast devoted to all things Jericho.
We're just holding on to these traditions like nothing happened out there?
We're holding on to these traditions because of what happened out there.
Find us at www.jerichopodcast.blogspot.com.
And we're back.
Hello.
I hear you have an email for us.
I'm going to have a quick one. It's just a little quickie here, and I've been trying to do some research to get something posted up more definitely on the website, so look for that. But here it is. This comes to us from Stu Schiffman. He says, "Hi, Babylon podcasters. I just got a mailing from the Revell Model People, featured for 2009, A Star Fury and the Babylon 5 Station."
Hmm.
Yeah, like I said, I've been... in communication with Stu, trying to get some more information. I got to do a little more digging and poking, so as soon as we know more. But all you modelers out there, new Babylon 5 models. That's really cool stuff.
So it's just the station and the Star Fury?
That's all Stu said. That's what I said. I'm trying to find more information. So I guess that's as much a teaser to whet everyone's appetite.
I want to know
if anybody knows more. Yeah, you send it.
I want to know why they haven't done a model of B4. You know, the Babylon 4 station.
Right.
I don't think I've ever seen a ship or a model of that station.
I know I haven't. Well, you know what? I saw one on the shelf one time, and then it just kind of rippled and disappeared in front of my eyes.
Oh, jeez.
So, you know, I don't know. Maybe I imagined it.
Hmm.
I understand they had a problem with the kits of the first three. They kept blowing up on the shelves.
Nice. I'm having a vague memory of Legos, of Lego B5 stuff. I don't know, though.
Lego B5 stuff. Somebody out there has got to do it.
I don't know if that was a fever dream or or a memory from an alternate universe, but I think a Lego B5 would be really cool.
I think so, too. A Lego Zocalo?
Oh, wow. Complete with little Lego aliens running around.
Yeah, little Lego Drazi. I'd like to see that.
Lego Pac-Mara. Oh. Okay, that's just silly.
I like that. Lego Centauri.
We need to have somebody like email Revell and go, hey, why don't you guys license the Babylon 4 station? Yeah. Give us one of that. And then contact the Lego people and say, hey, you know, there's a whole arena of people, you know, kind of like Star Wars fans, only more rabid. Couple B5 fans.
Smarter, but more rabid.
Yeah, think about it.
Yeah.
I think if we get enough people writing in asking for Lego B5, they might do it. Not by this Christmas, but hey, next Christmas we could get a pleasant surprise. Yeah. And Brad in the chat room is saying Lego Zima bottles for the Zocalo. Nice. There you go. On that note, I think we have a voicemail from our good friend Edmund.
Yes.
Hi, guys. It's Edmund from Greenville with some changeling news. Don't worry, there is a B5 angle here, aside from their common creator. First, in case anyone's been put off by a middling review or two, and as they've been discussing on Slice, why are you listening to jaded mainstream reviewers anyway? Harlan Ellison has posted his thoughts on his forum. I cannot recommend it highly enough. It is a stunner, without flaw or misstep. Do not deny yourself this artifact. It has been so long since a film treated me as intelligently, as decently, as adultly as this. I'd almost forgotten what it was to come out of a theater enriched. Changeling. See it. And as anyone familiar with Harlan's criticism can tell you, he wouldn't let his friendship with JMS get in the way if he thought it was a steaming pile of equine feces. Second, JMS was interviewed on NPR. It's still up at npr.org. And here's the B5 angle. It includes this clip from the film.
I used to always tell him, you never start a fight, but you always finish it. And I didn't start this fight, but I'm going to finish it.
So, what do you think? Did JMS decide a good line bears repeating, especially to give a tip of the hat to the B5 fans he knew would be in the audience? Or, given that he first heard about this story in his early days as a reporter, was Papa Sheridan's advice cribbed from his research? Be seeing you.
Well, if Harlan Ellison recommends it, I don't know. It's a period piece, a period drama. I usually don't go see those in the theater anyway.
Uh-huh.
But I am planning to see it on DVD. And I've heard other reviews that were also, you know, praising it.
The one review that I have read so far was in, Entertainment Weekly. I can't remember if it was that or People. I think it was Entertainment Weekly. That in the doctor's office, and they gave it a solid C.
Really?
Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah. And in fact, they said that the story was a little heavy-handed. But take that for what that's worth, jaded mainstream critic, who knows.
Yeah.
But they did have an interesting note. Well, they actually quoted J. Michael, not quoted, but they mentioned him by name, that screenwriter J. Michael Straczynski first heard of the story from a friend at the LAPD who was burning old case records.
Burning them?
Burning them.
They actually burn old cases?
Apparently so. And I don't know the whole story. My guess is something like, hey, Joe, here's something you might be interested in.
Huh.
So I don't know. I don't know all the ins and outs. And it was literally just a two-sentence sidebar. So
I had no idea they actually burned old case files. I thought everything went to like an archive or a cold case storage. Interesting.
Yeah, I did not know.
Yeah. Okay.
Anyways, there you are.
Anything else?
Nope, I think that'll do it for this show.
All righty. In that case, we are done. This you have your own voicemail to send. You can email that in to babylonpodcast@gmail.com. If you want to start an argument or contribute to the the 83x9x12 never-ending thread, you can find that in the Babylon Podcast Forum over at farpointforums.com. Please donate. Help keep the studio afloat in these tough times. Every little bit helps, trust me. If you want to call in your own voicemail, that number is 206-338-2259. That's 206-338-2259.
See you, the great war came upon us all.
And we'll see you next time on the other side of the Lego Jump Gate.